So this is Yale Law student Casey Arnold interviewing Van Ness Feldman attorney and Yale Law alumnus Robert Nordhaus, Bob Nordhaus. We're here to finish up the interview that we started yesterday, and we are in the Van Ness Feldman offices in D.C., and it's approximately 10:42 a.m. on Friday, November 9th. So when we left off yesterday, Reagan had just been elected and you had left FERC. Yeah. So following your departure from FERC, you joined Van Ness Feldman.
Yes.
And when you were considering what your options were, knowing that you were going to have to leave FERC, did you consider trying to remain in government and sort of maybe a nonpartisan office, or did you know that you were going to switch to private practice, and what other job possibilities did you consider?
Well, the at that point, I was a political appointee, and it would have been very difficult to get, certainly to get a political appointment in the Reagan administration, having worked for Carter and the Carter White House, and would have been also, I think, difficult to get a career position in another executive agency. Might have been possible to go back to the Hill, but I think at that point I was ready to do something else. So I did talk to a number of law firms, had several other offers. I guess the principal other offer was from a boutique antitrust firm, the name of which I can't remember, which wanted to expand its practice into energy law. And I had a former colleague who was working there already. They made me a very nice offer, quite a bit more than what Van Ness offered, but ultimately I decided that that I wanted to work with people I'd worked with on the Hill and at FERC, and to work rather than build a practice on my own, to work with people who already had a budding energy practice and people who were very much in the center of things on public policy issues. So came here at considerably less compensation that the other firm offered me. It turned out to be a much wiser choice than I realized, because the other firm went under it about a year and a half later when their antitrust work dried up as a result of changing antitrust policies from the Reagan administration. So it turned out to be very fortunate that I, from a survival point of view, that I ended up here, but also turned out to be a very rewarding place to work, because we had a very viable energy law practice, both regulatory and legislative, really had a good time. And one of the things we did in that era was to start up what was known as a PURPA practice. That is this was a practice dealing with renewable energy and combined heat and power electric generation facilities that had been given access to electric power markets under a statute enacted as part of the Carter Energy legislation, the Public Utility Regulatory Policies Act. When I was at FERC, we worked on the implementing regulations, and once here had a chance to actually work on real projects that were affected or were seeking rights under these implementing regulations. And it turned out that this was the first wave of independent power producers, which have become at this point about half, a little more than half of the generation in this country is controlled by independent power producers. The first of those were the clients that we represented in the immediate aftermath of PURPA. So it was sort of exciting, and this client group were the functional equivalent of oil wildcatters. They were entrepreneurial, not the staid utility executives you were accustomed to dealing with, and most of them went under, but a number of them ended up becoming very central in today's industry. So that was I spent 12 years after the demise of the Carter administration here at the law firm doing mostly energy law, some environmental law, and we built a, we did what we lovingly call FERC work, and built a FERC practice in those years, which is the mainstay of the FERC's practice to this day. Toward the end of my first stint at the law firm, with the election of the first George Bush, environmental law came back to the forefront with the Bush proposal to rewrite the Clean Air Act. As I mentioned, I'd been rather deeply involved in the original statute. We ended up doing a tremendous amount of work on the 1990 Clean Air Act amendments for a variety of clients, and I guess drafted five or six cap and trade programs for clients. This is the acid rain program, cap and trade programs for various clients and for offices on the Hill that couldn't get the help they needed out of the House or Senate Legislative Council's office. So we drafted a number of versions of the acid rain cap and trade program for members on the Hill. That was eventually enacted at the end of 1990, and we spent the next 2 years working on implementation of that statute and also on the next major piece of legislation in our area going through Congress, which was the Energy Policy Act of 1992, which made major changes in regulation of federal regulation of electricity and natural gas. At the end of 1992, of course, we had the 1992 election. Clinton was elected. I inadvertently became a major financial force in the Clinton campaign, or at least was so regarded, in that what happened was I got an invitation, or I got a request to sponsor a fundraising event for Clinton and Gore in October 1992 from some friends in another law firm. And I called them and said, well, I can't do it because I'm going to be trekking in Nepal then. And they said, okay. And next thing I know, this is before I left for Nepal, the invitation comes out listing me as a sponsor, and I'm outraged. I never agreed to sponsor. I call them up and say, I didn't agree to sponsor this. Why is my name on it? They said, oh, well, we're very sorry, but you know, we can't change it now. Would you really mind? I said, well, all right. And then I get a bunch of calls from people who want to know about the fundraiser, and they and I tell them, oh, you ought to go. It's a great fundraiser. And somehow I got credit for all these people who called and asked me whether they should attend, even though I'd objected to having my name on the thing in the first place, so at which point I became a sort of minor player in the Clinton fundraising universe. and actually on the on a white list in the White House personnel office, which I didn't know until at the time. Anyway, that was an amusing incident during the campaign. After Clinton was elected, during the transition, he named Hazel O'Leary as Secretary of Energy Designate. She was somebody I had worked with back in the Carter administration. And she approached me and asked me, she approached me and asked me whether I wanted to be general counsel of the Department of Energy. And I thought I knew a lot about the Department of Energy because I actually, when I was working in the Carter White House, one of my drafting tasks had been in the middle of drafting the Carter Energy Program, providing a lot of drafting assistance on the Department of Energy Organization Act, which was they were working on at the same time, and had worked pretty closely with Jim Schlesinger and his lieutenants in the early days of the Department of Energy. So I took the job, or said I would take the job. It took 5 or 6 months to get me nominated and confirmed. Once there was an announcement that I had been, that I was to be nominated as general counsel, I went over to DOE as a consultant. And first day I got there, DOE was in the middle of a battle with the Treasury Department over the design of the what was known as the BTU tax, which was a centerpiece of Clinton's tax and energy program that he put forward in his early months of his presidency. And they plopped this thing, and luckily I had a pretty good tax background, plopped this thing, I'm just a consultant, not even general counsel at that point, plopped this thing down in front of me. I was the only person at DOE who understood anything about, enough about tax law to figure out what was going on and to advise them on what to do. The next thing I know, I'm marched into a, the next morning, into a meeting with the then chief of staff, and meeting at the White House with the then chief of staff and the guy who was running their legislative operation, where we got into the middle of what was going on the Hill and the BTU tax and the battle over how to design it. 2 days later, I was in the Oval Office with Gore and Clinton when they made a decision as to how to design on the design issues of the tax. They actually went our way, which was an early victory, but I think the last victory we had at the White House over in the entire 4 years I was there. Anyway, once I was confirmed, what became clear about DOE was that it had very little to do with that. The work there had very little to do with energy, and I used to describe it as the Department of Bombs, Garbage, and Science, and that was because most of its budget went for the nuclear weapons program and for cleanup of former nuclear weapons manufacturing sites. And then the next largest chunk after those two went to a major science program, which funded operations at some 14 national laboratories. Energy, as it turned out, was a bit of an afterthought. And as general counsel, spent most of my time on really on cleanup, legal cleanup from the weapons program, and we had a series of I'd say most of my time was spent not on energy law but on tort law, because we had a series of huge class actions that had been brought against DOE's contractors, and those contractors had contracts, had full cost reimbursement contracts with DOE that made DOE liable for all judgments against them, no matter how much they were at fault, unless it was intentional misconduct or bad faith. So we were on the hook for all of the whole series of contractor missteps over the going back to the Manhattan Project. And the reason they were still being litigated for the most part was that as the veil of secrecy over the nuclear weapons program was lifted over the years, the facts about the various accidents and incidents that occurred that had resulted in radiation exposure to large populations surrounding these facilities around the country had become public. So we spent I'd say the biggest single thing I had to do as general counsel was deal with these class actions. We also had a rather striking incident or case that came up while I was general counsel. Was what was known as the human radiation experiments, which had been conducted during the Manhattan Project in 1945. These were experiments where the doctors mostly for the University of California, a contractor to the Manhattan, then to the Manhattan Project, now a contractor to DOE, where the physicians from the university had injected human subjects with plutonium to figure out how long it would take to pass through their bodies and what the exposure, what damage to their bodies exposure to plutonium would do. The problem, of course, was these were what they thought were terminally ill patients. They didn't bother to tell them that they were being injected with plutonium. And it turned out, in fact, that a number of them weren't terminally ill and lived for a number of years afterwards. But this had been kept secret for almost 50 years, and the secret finally came out in the early 90s. The families, the plaintiff's lawyers located the families of the various victims, and we had a huge flap, lawsuits, a advisory committee that was set up, questions as to what the standard of care was, or the standard for conducting experiments on human patients was in 1945, and the standard, as it turned out, was the standard that was developed by the Nuremberg Tribunal in trying Nazi doctors. So, and by that standard, we had violated the University of California had violated the norms for human experiments even then. That took a number of years to resolve. We finally settled it, along with several of the other class actions. A number of the class actions were not settled. Number of them are still going. It's now 15 years after I left DOE, and I'd say I think at least two of them are still in the courts. But that was one of the more interesting aspects of, and I'd say surprising aspects of the DOE work, was the spending a lot of time on basic tort law. Another example of that was at one point in the late 40s at Hanford, which is the Manhattan Project nuclear weapons facility in eastern Washington. The Atomic Energy Commission decided it needed to find out how radioactive, if they had an accident, how radioactive iodine would disperse in the atmosphere. So they deliberately dispersed some radioactive iodine, which can from I think a stack at Hanford, contaminated 5 or 6 western states with it, never told anybody about it, came to light years later, in which case a massive class action was brought to compensate anybody who had developed thyroid cancer as a result of this exposure. As far as we could tell, nobody had actually developed it, but this was a claim for medical monitoring, which would have been imposed huge liabilities on the government. Liabilities on the contractors who did the work, but those liabilities would have to be indemnified by the government under the then applicable contracts. So this was another example of how we ended up spending most of our time working on tort law issues while at DOE. And these cases, we tried to settle the cases. We spent a lot of time on litigation management. At one point in the Hanford case, there were 11 law firms representing the contractors, two for each. There were 6 contractors who had been involved over the years in this, and each of them was allowed 2 law firms, so there were, and one of them had only one, but so we had 11 law firms representing the various contractors. We finally had to consolidate the defense and fired 10 of the 11, which saved us $25 million a year and actually had a more efficient defense. So that's an example of some of the more bizarre work we did at DOE. There's also more traditional energy law work, working on climate issues, trying to work on energy efficiency standards for appliances, which one of the great disappointments when I was there is we never got a single standard out because the bureaucracy at DOE was so entangled that they were incapable of actually getting out energy efficiency standards. But that was a interesting and usually frustrating period of time, and the coming away from it, I felt, that we'd done a lot of work. It was good, as good work as one could expect under the circumstances, given the hand we had been dealt with, particularly in litigation. But the results were not always in contrast to my stint at FERC, where we won virtually every major case that had gone to the Court of Appeals. DOE's track record, where DOE was represented by the Department of Justice, FERC had its own lawyers. DOE's track record was terrible, and it wasn't just the lawyering. I think it was really the underlying decisions that the department made over the years that made its life so difficult in the courts. And the DOE really didn't believe that NEPA applied to it, and which of course it did, but they kept losing major NEPA cases. In fact, one of the low moments at DOE was when we lost two major NEPA cases on the same day. And these were cases, the underlying NEPA work had been done during the Bush administration, but we had this legacy of cases from prior administrations that we had to deal with, and it was really quite difficult to deal with them successfully. So anyway, that's a short discussion of the travails of trying to be DOE's lawyer.
Okay, well, it sounds like you certainly had a very interesting time while you were there. To come back quickly to your first stint at Van Ness Feldman, you said that one of the reasons you came was because you had some colleagues here. So did most of the attorneys in the office at the time have a similar background to you, or what kinds of people were you working with?
When I arrived, I think with one exception, two exceptions, all of the partners were people I'd worked with on the Hill. And some of them had gone off and done other, had worked in executive branch agencies after leaving the Hill. Had one partner who was a litigator who had never worked in government, and another partner who had been general counsel of EPA and had worked in government a good deal, but had never worked on the Hill. But for the most part, the vast majority of people at the partner level had worked on the Hill, the House and Senate, and for the most part had worked together back before or during the Carter administration, worked together on the Hill at that point. I had worked with Charles Curtis, both on the committee, on the Interstate and Foreign Commerce Committee staff, and at FERC, where he had been chairman when I was general counsel. And the two of us joined he had been a founding partner of the law firm for about 3 months, left the firm early in the Carter administration to take the job of chairman at the Federal Power Commission and then at FERC. And then he and I came to the firm at the same time at the end of the Carter administration. And I had a number of other colleagues from FERC and the Hill who joined us at that point. Plus, there were, I'd say, five or six partners who were there already who I'd worked with on the Hill. So it was a very close-knit group of lawyers who had worked together for many years in a different capacity, and who, for the most part, were whose major experience had been legislative. And when the FERC contingent arrived in 1981, it was at that point that we had significant background on regulatory issues that would permit us to have a broader based practice than just a Hill practice.
What did you miss most about working in government once you came here?
I think the problem about the problem with private practice is you're supposed to do what your client wants. And when you're in government, and the same thing in government, but your government client, you have much more influence over what your government client says it wants as a government lawyer than you do over a private client's policies or direction. So I think what I missed most about government work was the sort of narrow range of issues that one would deal with in private practice, because basically, you know, somebody comes to you and wants some tiny little fix on the, say, fuel economy regulations. They're not interested in the bigger picture of whether the current program is working correctly and what needs to be done to fix it. They just want their little problem fixed. The upside I found of private practice was you really, as opposed to being general counsel of an agency, was that you really had time and resources to do a much more thorough job yourself. As general counsel of an agency, you're relying on, you know, you have 200 or 300 lawyers working for you. You don't really get to do your own work on very much. You review stuff, go to meetings, send little notes to people, but it's rare that you can actually sit down and write a memo, draft a brief, draft a statute. And so it's always doing it, looking at somebody else's work and correcting it. And so I thought one of the refreshing things about private practice was that you could actually do your own work. And our firm is unusual since its inception and to this day is an unusual kind of firm, because it's you know, the traditional law firm structure is a pyramid where you have a small number of equity partners, contract partners, associates, paralegals, and our firm is pyramidal, but it's an upside down pyramid because we have many more partners than associates. I mean, more than twice as many partners as associates, and that's largely, I think, we're not a litigation firm, but it's a function of how we work, which is the individual partners have most of the expertise, and it's hard and inefficient to try to have, and a lot of our work, have associates do the first draft of something and then rewrite it. It's basically because you end up putting more time, more partner time, plus the associate time, doing it that way than if you simply did it yourself from the beginning. But this, you know, the clients like it this way, we like it this way. It's not necessarily the most lucrative way to run a law firm, as you could understand. That, you know, what makes the traditional law firm profitable is having a swarm of associates working on any given project, billing them at a rate that's far in excess of their salary, and then letting that go to a profit pool for the partners. Of course, if you have many partners and few associates, that theory that leverage doesn't work, that leverage doesn't exist. But what we found is that from the point of view of our practice, that our upside down pyramid has worked very well for us, both from the point of view of personal satisfaction in the practice and from the point of view of making a living off of the practice, which all of us seem to be doing.
So you mentioned that maybe this isn't the most lucrative way to run a firm, and also that you had another higher paid offer that you declined. But in shifting from being a government employee to being a private practice attorney, did you feel that there was a shift somewhere in your sort of socioeconomic status at all, or?
Not really. I mean, I don't think my lifestyle changed significantly. I mean, I had kids that were had to be sent to private school and ultimately to college. And so that I think it would have been much more difficult to do that comfortably on a government salary. But I didn't feel that my lifestyle ratcheted up significantly as a result of all of this, but that may be more me personally than having to do with the change from, you know, I guess, you know, partly it's just my personal style, which is I'm cheap, but but I, you know, so I think it's looking back, I'm sure that if I'd stayed in government, my lifestyle would have been somewhat more constrained, and I would have spent less time on vacations, and probably wouldn't have had a second home as easily as I was able to have one. Actually, the second home was built while I was in DOE, and it was not the most expensive enterprise anyway. But part of my cheap gene. But I would say it probably didn't make that much difference in my life or how I perceived myself.
While you were working here, did you, and I guess your colleagues, did you follow FERC's work during the Reagan and Bush 41 years, and how did you feel about how things were going?
I did, you know, I had a FERC practice in those years and followed it very carefully. I think FERC is a independent regulatory agency, and as an agency that was carrying out a fairly explicit instructions, at least in some areas from Congress, was not like EPA in that era, and that it didn't go off the deep end on policies that were highly controversial on the Hill, and it actually took some important steps to free up the natural gas and electric industries from counterproductive regulatory policies. But we follow that very closely, and I would say on the whole that what FERC was doing during that era was generally pretty constructive, and it was a period of great disruption in the natural gas and electric industries because of exogenous changes such as in the gas industry, oil and natural gas prices, which had been very high in the late 70s and early 80s, collapsed in 1985, which left, particularly in the natural gas industry, left pipelines holding high-priced natural gas contracts, which with producers, which and put them in, and the gas was priced so high that they couldn't sell it to their regular customers. And a number of pipelines had to go through. It was a very tough time for the pipelines. A number of them went into Chapter 11, and there were years of litigation over these what are called take-or-pay contracts. And FERC tried to, as best it could, manage this transition from high-priced to low-priced gas, trying to make the market more efficient, to get out of a regulatory paradigm where every wholesale natural gas transaction had to be approved by FERC. And so I think, yeah, but we pay a lot of attention to that. And the electric side, I think, as we mentioned, one of the major factors in that era was the nuclear building boom, which sort of peaked in the mid-80s. There were no new starts after Three Mile Island, but all of the projects that had been started before then were coming online, and there were massive rate increases, which triggered all kinds of issues with state regulation and federal regulation, a couple of major bankruptcies. And that was a very disruptive period, and FERC tried to manage its way through that also, and I thought did a pretty good job.
Okay, so as we've discussed a little bit, in 1993, you left the firm to become the general counsel of the Department of Energy. Did you know in advance that Hazel O'Leary was thinking about tapping you, or how?
No, it was a total surprise to me that she was tapped to be Secretary of Energy, and once that was announced, then she approached me and asked me if I was interested in being general counsel.
And could you tell us a little bit about what the nomination and confirmation process was like?
Slow. I was not a controversial nominee because I had worked on the Hill and knew the knew the principal members of the Senate Energy Committee well, and so the only so the vetting process in the Clinton White House was even slower than that in the Carter White House, so it took 2 or 3 months between the time that Hazel had asked me to become general counsel and the time they actually sent the nomination up to the Hill, and then another 3 or 4 months, I guess 3 months, before I was confirmed, but it was not through and just the more the press of business in the committee and trying to get the nomination through the committee and through the floor took time, and so I thought it was relatively quick for me by comparison to some of the other, anybody who had some degree of controversy surrounding their nomination. And so I think I was confirmed at the end of July. So it was about 6 months to go through the process.
Did you find it at all difficult to transition back into government practice?
Not really, and among other reasons, because I was familiar with the Department of Energy. The deputy general counsel, the career deputy general counsel there, was somebody I'd worked with since the time of the Arab oil embargo, when he was head of the Federal Energy Office, which was the office that Nixon had set up to deal with the embargo. He was not the head, but the general counsel of that office. And so I didn't find the transition at all difficult, other than the work had nothing to do with energy, which I had done virtually nothing on tort law since law school. And so I had to get back up to speed on tort law, class actions, a whole series of a bunch of issues with respect to government contract law. One of the things we did early on was to try to reform DOE's contracting practices. And that those are the practices that led to, among other things, all these class action suits, because DOE was on the hook for anything the contractors did, no matter how stupid. So it was a lot of stuff to learn or relearn, but the transition back to government was not at all difficult. It seemed to me that, at that point, I'd spent most of my career in government anyway, and had been at the law firm 12 years, but had been in government before then 14 years.
How did you feel that what you learned in the 12 years that you'd spent in private practice impacted and benefited what you did at the government level?
Well, the first thing I think was that the DOE employed a lot of law firms indirectly through its contractors. And my experience in private practice gave me a much better, gave me a very good sense as to how to manage outside law firms. And when I got there, we had no litigation management program, and the contractors managed the lawyers they retained, even though we were paying for the lawyers and for any judgment or settlement that came out of a lawsuit against the contractors. So one of the things that private practice did was to make me very aware of what constituted abusive practices by law firms, what the standard of practice should be. That was very helpful. And I think I'd really grown up as a government lawyer, and so the whole government law practice as a government lawyer was very familiar to me. But I think the private practice experience made me much more conscious of, first of all, making sure you knew who your client was, and that you were, that even if you had a government client, the government lawyer's job was not to set government policy, but to help those who were setting it carry out that policy. And I think that there's a lot of, one of the occupational hazards of being a career government lawyer is you tend to think that you're in charge rather than your client. And so I think that the mindset of the private practitioner, the lawyer in private practice, which is you have a client, you're there to help the client, not to advance your own agenda, was I think very helpful.
So obviously you were doing different jobs within the two administrations, but how did working under Clinton compare to having worked under Carter?
Well, there were different, a couple of things. Well, the general counsel's offices were different, first of all, in that at FERC we had our own litigation authority. So, and at any given time we were litigating 50 or 75 cases in the courts of appeal, federal courts. And at DOE, we didn't litigate. We carried the briefcase for the Department of Justice litigators. So it was a much different role from the point of view of litigation anyway, in that you were you are the ostensibly the client, not the lawyer, once you got into judicial litigation. And that was, I found that a little frustrating, because I think at FERC we were accountable for the litigation work and had a staff that was very capable, and we won most of our cases. At DOE, we didn't really have control over how our litigation was managed, or what position, in many cases, the government took. And part of that is understandable in that there are other agencies involved, sometimes adverse to us. So, and the Department of Justice had to decide what the government's litigation position was and would tell one agency or the other, sorry, we're going to go with the other agency rather than with you on this case. So that was a sort of important structural difference, which had to do with the job, not the administration. As far as the administrations were concerned, I thought the first thing about the Clinton, if you compare the Clinton and Carter White Houses, the Clinton White House was really knew what it was doing politically in a way that Carter administration was essentially clueless in dealing with Congress, even though they had massive Democratic majorities throughout their 4 years. Clinton had his early difficulties with Congress, but the Clinton White House were superb politically. They really, they lost, they had their problems with health care and so on, but they were as capable a political operation as any I've seen since I've been in Washington. And that meant that that trickled down to the cabinet agencies, and of course our agency was always in trouble for one reason or another, the human radiation experiments. Our Secretary O'Leary had a penchant for high profile government travel, which got her in trouble with the Republicans, who then at the second half of my 4 years there controlled Congress. So we spent a lot of time worrying about Hazel's travel, and every time some flap would occur, Hazel would get in trouble in the press or on the Hill. The chief of staff and I would get summoned over to the White House to explain what Hazel was doing. In many cases, we didn't know either. But so we spent, there was a lot of time, a lot of direct and not necessarily pleasant contact with the White House, trying to deal with various public relations disasters that had occurred on our watch. And that was very different from FERC, in that FERC was an independent regulatory agency, was not under control either the secretary or the White House, and we had our own litigation authority. We sent our budgets to OMB, but the OMB had no authority to review our regulations, nor were we subject to. We were not accountable to the White House, so we would, we didn't have any public relations flaps, but had we had them, none of us would have been summoned to the White House to explain to the chief of staff what was going on, which was always, you know, a somewhat demeaning position to be in, particularly when you weren't responsible for whatever the flap was. But so it was a very different, you know, structurally very different kind of job. But I think it was also a very different administration in that it'd be hard to imagine Jimmy Carter's White House summoning some errant secretary or some errant secretary's staff over to dress them down for some unfortunate article that appeared in the Wall Street Journal, for instance. But that happened all the time in the Clinton White House. And, you know, I can well understand why they were concerned, frankly, but it was about every 2 months there'd be a summons from the chief of staff for somebody wanting an explanation of what was going on.
So you returned to Van Esfelman in 1997. Could you tell us a little bit about your departure from DOE?
Yeah, I had decided early on that I was only going to do 4 years, even if Clinton was reelected. And so I stayed at DOE through February of 1997. And because I had a major drafting project that I wanted to get finished, which was the Clinton administration electric power reform initiative, electric deregulation initiative, and so I wanted to get that finished and delivered before I left, which I did. And so I, you know, finished, and I had three or four. I wanted to settle the human radiation cases. We had a major case involving or dispute involving a canceled scientific project called the Superconducting Super Collider, or maybe it was the Super Collider. It was a large proton accelerator that was to be built in Texas, and they got about halfway through, at which point Congress canceled it to the state of Texas's extreme unhappiness, and we spent about 2 years negotiating with the state on how they would be reimbursed for the money they had put into the project. And then we had to deal with the state lands office and a bunch of other people. And then we were also in the middle of selling a oil field in California, and I had some negotiations on that had to be finished up. So I got that done, left on March 1st, 1997, and took about 3 or 4 months off, partly to decompress and partly to figure out what I was going to do next. Decided I wanted to go back into private practice, talked to a lot of different law firms, had a number of offers from large law firms. Ultimately decided I'd be most comfortable coming back here, which I did, and that turned out to be a good choice, I think.
Okay, well, we will go ahead and take a break now, okay. And then when we come back, we'll talk about the rest of your time at Van Esfelman.
Okay, good.